1905 to 1977.
Leave him crying. It's not uncommon. You think you know somebody, and then you learn he had a completely other side.
They all think they know my dad. They say, "That sounds just like your dad." And they are right. They do know my dad. They know him as the man at Kitty's birthday party. Needing someone to pop out of a cake like a Playboy bunny, they called Dad. They built a plywood and tissue paper cake and gave him his costume, long underwear with a pink voile ruffle. Knowing he would lose his nerve, they also supplied a few drops of liquid courage. And so, three sheets to the wind, Dad didn't really pop out of that cake. He stumbled. They know my dad as the man who hijacked a party. In the days of hijackings to Cuba, Dad's friend Donna hosted a flyaway party. Deciding that Donna's party needed a surprise, Dad and his sidekick, my mother, dressed in black with paint smeared across their faces, they snuck into the basement, flipped the switch that plunged the party into darkness, and kidnapped Donna. Leaving behind a briefcase wired with firecrackers and a ransom note demanding tequila with a worm, they calmed a hysterical Donna and made her party a hit. They know my dad as the man who, just like Andy Hardy, said, "Let's put on a show," each Christmas for his department at work. One year, he was Miss Piggy. Another year, he set the skit to rap music. He was the man who treated his ladies at work to lunch on his birthday. It started simply enough. When pantsuits first became acceptable for women, my dad said jokingly, "Couldn't you wear dresses in honor of my birthday tomorrow?" When every woman came dressed to the nines, Dad rewarded them with lunch. For the next 20 years, that lunch grew from a one-hour bite of food to an event. When his department grew to 22 women and was too large to drop in at a restaurant, he reserved party rooms around town. When the women suggested a little wine might be nice, the event moved to our house. They know my dad as the man who coached all my brother's teams. In Little League, he had only two rules. Rule one, parents had to keep their mouths shut. No yelling at the kids, the umps, or the coaches. Rule two, throw the ball home. Always. Tired of watching the ball go from third to an overthrown first base to an overshot second, his strategy was simple. Let them think they hit a home run, we'll get them out at the plate. They all think they know my dad, but they are wrong. They don't know my dad. They don't know that as a young father with his own kids safely tucked into their beds, he received a phone call in the middle of the night from a distraught employee. Her daughter, a survivor of many suicide attempts, was missing. Would my dad help search? They didn't know that he sat in a car with the mother as the first light fell on Lake Olathe and the abandoned car sitting on the cliffs. They didn't see him as he waited while the lake was searched and the body recovered. They didn't see him come home hours later with bits of mud and morning dew on his cuffs. They didn't see him check on his own sleeping kids that gray morning. They don't know that any scraped knee could be made better with his "there, there, there," or that he cried so hard when he left me at college that he had to pull off the road, or that he sat alone on the steps of our house as I left him after my wedding. They don't know that even after I was married, my dad would just happen to be in the neighborhood as he appeared at the hospitals to sit with my husband during my many surgeries. They don't know that, at my brother's wedding, my dad followed the showbiz motto, "Leave 'em crying." As he spoke about my brother, there wasn't a dry eye in the place. After my dad toasted my brother, saying, "I couldn't be more proud of you, and I love you dearly," my brother's tough-as-nails friends were red-eyed and jealous. Jealous that he had a dad who told him, in public, what they had never been told, even in private. Russ Ann Opperman, Olathe, Kansas, Girl Friday, daughter of Lloyd Moore, aviation business, 1931.
The Gambler. Not exactly a model father, but he was unforgettable, and in his way, generous.
In a rooming house in Seattle, Charlie died alone. We hadn't been in touch for years when I learned this. Why had he moved from Oakland to Seattle? I asked his union steward. Because he wanted to be near Long Acres Racetrack. He wanted to be cremated and have his ashes strewn over the track, which was done. Perfect. That was my father, an alcoholic and a gambler. I've made him instead a Damon Runyon character in my mind. My mother once told me she divorced him because the bookies were threatening to kidnap you. What I remember is standing beside him at Santa Anita, yelling, "Come on, my daddy's horse!" The one he bet on, not the one he owned. I was 3, and he had kidnapped me and taken me across the country by train. My mother came to take me back, and he followed. In Chicago, we would walk to boxing matches amid a loud crowd of characters jumping from their seats to shout, spilling beer from paper cups, the women in fake furs and heavily made up. At 6, with platinum blonde hair and my father's blue eyes, I must have seemed out of place, but I didn't know it. Walking home, Charlie would hold out his hand and rub his thumb against his fingers, saying, "Feel that air," while holding my hand with his other. As we walked, I sang, "Jesus loves me, this I know, for the Bible tells me so," as I'd been taught by my California grandmother. Charlie didn't say much about himself. He did tell me, though, that the ship he served on during World War II had been torpedoed, and that only he and several others survived, rescued after 2 days and 3 nights in the dark, in the drink, he said. Did he ever vote or drive a car? I don't know. But he did wake me one snowy night when he returned from working the night shift at the Tribune, it must have been midnight, to dress me warmly and take me for a ride on my sled. He wore a suit and hat to his blue-collar job. From various venues, he sent me age-inappropriate gifts, such as a royal portable typewriter when I was 7 and a strand of real cultured pearls when I was 8, which I later realized he had probably bought from a fence in a bar in Detroit. At the time, though, this seemed normal. Sometimes he'd visit, and sometimes I'd visit with him at his brother's in Ohio. At 7, I went to live for good with my mother's parents in a Chicago suburb, where Grandpa Gilbert read to me whenever I wanted him to and let me play in the leaves he had raked. Still, Charlie was my father. Yes, he left me for whatever his reasons. He left me his love of words and his good genes. My grandmother died at 96 and her sister at 98, and many memories, some heart-wrenching, others heartwarming. He left me, too, his independence and somewhat antisocial attitude. I didn't know him nearly as well as I ought to have, but I do know that while I drink hardly at all and cannot bear to gamble, probably because my mother actually took my nickel when I lost a bet to her at the age of 5, I am so my father's daughter. Still. Judith Pettijohn McConnell, Chicago, Illinois, student, daughter of Charles Elbert Pettijohn, newspaper mailer, 1915 to 1983.
The Joker. He will always think of his dad with a smile, or more often, a good laugh. What a gift.
My father is deeply ridiculous. He's not above doing the wave when his son is in a spelling bee or is inducted into an honor society. When a nosy aunt inquired if I had a girlfriend, he told her I had several women to satisfy my physical urges, but nothing serious. When I was in college, he sat down at my men's chorus concert and asked when the beer vendor was coming. In high school, he was the parent that my friends wanted to come with us on field trips. Between my father and his father, a man who was known to yell across a crowded store or church when he lost sight of you, I have a very high threshold for embarrassment. I gave up being embarrassed about my father around the end of high school But I didn't truly appreciate his silliness until his father died. I can't cry for him, my father said. I think of the things he did, and I start laughing. My father was an altar boy when they still said the Mass in Latin. When he held the paten under his friends, he'd slap them on the chin. He'd loosen the bells after Mass so the altar boy of the next Mass would shake them during the consecration and lose them all over the place. But beneath the irreverence and the silliness, he wears a Catholic working man's sense of honor. Scratch a cynic, they say, and you get an idealist. It might not be in this lifetime, he told me, but the guys in the white hats always win. I was a reader in church in college, and one passage from the Gospel of Luke resonated with me. Jesus said, "When you have done all you are ordered to do, say, 'I am a worthless servant who has done no more than his duty.' My father wears a sense of nobility, and an ability to do the right thing, not out of personal gain, fear, or guilt, but because it is his duty. Because he's doing nothing more than his duty, he doesn't accept praise well. When someone told him he had two fine sons, he said, 'They were raised by wolves.'" A friend of the family who knows a little about bearing crosses told my father at one point that he was due a special place in heaven. His response, "All I was trying to do was get out of a little purgatory." Vince Guerreri, Fremont, Ohio, journalist. Son of Chuck Guerreri, nurse, claims worker, 1954.
The golfer. He taught his son to be frugal in a most unusual way.
Although my dad wasn't the most talented golfer in the world, he was one of the most unusual. What separated Dad from other golfers was not his swing or the clubs he used. It was his ability to play the game without ever purchasing a single ball. He let other golfers buy them and lose them for him to, eventually, find. I was about 7 when he started taking me with him when he golfed. Before I learned how to properly grip and swing a club, Dad taught me how to spot balls and use the retriever to pull them out of ponds without falling in. I can still remember the joy I felt when I presented Dad with a flawless Titleist that I plucked skillfully out of a water hazard. He made me feel like I found a gold nugget instead of a little white dimpled ball worth about $1. A few years later, Dad and my brother Mark taught me how to play golf, as I walked alongside them during many pleasurable days on the course. I always was amazed how my father consistently found golf balls in the most obscure places imaginable, stuck between tree branches, in piles of leaves, under rocks, and in other places where regular people would never look. Once he spotted a brand new ball tightly lodged under a tire of a car in a mall parking lot that was nowhere near a golf course. He had an unusual way of keeping score. "How'd you do, Dad?" I'd ask him. 8 over and 1 under, he'd reply. This meant he shot 8 over par, and his inventory of golf balls had dropped by 1 unit. He was meticulous about separating good, unscathed balls from uglier ones. Dad called the inferior ones water balls, because he didn't mind losing them on holes with water hazards. He kept balls in egg cartons and plastic bags and always had plenty in his golf bag, until the day he had no balls at all. One late summer afternoon, Dad went out alone to play 9 holes. When he got to the first tee and put his hand in the zipper compartment of his bag to pull out a ball, he came up completely empty. There were no balls in the trunk of the car either, but that didn't bother him. Instead of taking 10 minutes to drive home to get balls or, God forbid, buying some at the clubhouse, my father came up with a more imaginative solution to his predicament. He stuck a tee, another item he never purchased, into the ground and hit an invisible ball. He continued with his virtual round of golf until he got to the 3rd hole, where he found his first ball of the day. After 9 holes, both components of his score were over par. Arthur Feldman, Ann Arbor, Michigan, sales consultant, son of Jerome Feldman, accountant, 1921 to 1948. to 1989.
The Inventor. This dad gives new meaning to the old saying that there's more than one way to skin a cat.
He was an aircraft engineer, and in the evenings, he could always be found tinkering in the garage. In front of our middle-class home, he had 10 Chevy Vegas, and he would switch parts on one to get another one running so he could sell it. Sometimes, he'd take a carburetor he was working on and place it smack in the middle of our dining room table. While the family was eating dinner, he would try to figure out what was wrong so he could fix it. He didn't have to do this, but he was raised during the Depression, and he knew the value of a dollar. He was also an inventor. Because his kids all needed braces, he decided to make them himself. He boiled plastic football mouthguards and had us bite down long and hard to make a mold. Then he used a plastic cast to create the form. A combination of mold, leather strap, and rubber bands created a headgear that we only had to wear at bedtime, thank God. But it worked. We had straight teeth without orthodontia. Dad thought he was going to be doing the world a favor, so he advertised in the local newspaper about making custom-made braces. Unfortunately, the authorities saw the ad and made an appointment. That's when Dad sat us down and told us he might be going to jail for practicing dentistry without a license. We were terrified, but he got off with a very stiff fine. This wasn't the only time he decided he could be his own medical expert. When our cat developed a growth on the side of its head, Dad, with Mom assisting, decided to deal with it himself. He put the cat in a brown paper bag and, with the car running, added a little exhaust to knock the cat gently out. I often wondered how he knew how much exhaust would be enough without killing the cat. He opened the growth with a sterilized razor blade and drained it. Then he sewed it up with a regular needle and thread. The cat was fine by that evening and lived 5 more years until it was hit by a car. Carla Deshaun, Mission Viejo, California, domestic engineer, daughter of Jack C. Craig, aircraft engineer, 1925 to 2000.
Mr. Mom.
It's perfectly natural to honor the man who's been the only mother I've had for more than 30 years. Pat France Sircone, daughter of Richard L. France.
When I started thinking about this chapter, I asked my sisters whether they remembered any families in our old neighborhood in which the mother left or died and the father brought up the kids alone. "Are you kidding?" B.A. said. "If somebody lost his wife, he just went out and got another one." When I thought a little harder, I remembered that for a few days in our house, Dad took over Mom's responsibilities. Our mother suffered several miscarriages, and at one point she was in the hospital for over a week, leaving Dad to care for us in addition to his two jobs. He left for work early in the morning, but first he set the table and had oatmeal and hot chocolate waiting for us on the stove, along with a note reminding us to clear and rinse the breakfast dishes. We used to come home for lunch, and that week we went to a neighbor's, taking along our own lunches which Dad had packed. By the third or fourth day, when he had run out of peanut butter and bologna, Dad had no time to shop, he made us tomato sandwiches, which were a disappointment, to say the least. "Dad, just tomatoes?" "No, tomatoes with lots of salt and pepper," he said. He wasn't kidding, but if memory serves, we all survived. The first evening without Mom, Dad brought home a prepared meal. But he couldn't afford to do that more than once, so for the rest of the week we all pitched in, making meals and doing the various chores that defined Mom's day, and our neighbors and aunts helped too. Even so, I can still remember Dad cooking dinner, washing dishes, folding laundry, and vacuuming. Back then, it was really strange to see our dad in a domestic role. Within a couple of days, however, Dad seemed fairly comfortable at what was essentially his third job. We helped him in every way we could, and by the time Mom came back, we had grown accustomed to our new roles. In those days, a dad who did housework was something like a National League pitcher today. You want him to be able to pitch, and if he can hit a little too, it's a kind of amusing bonus. It's tough work to be a father, and tough too to be a mother. When one man is doing both jobs, well, as these stories make clear, That's a monumental achievement. The card. It's hard enough for a single father to take on a mother's role. It's twice as hard when his only child is a girl.
Every year in May, my father finds in his mailbox a Mother's Day card from his only child. This may seem strange, but it's perfectly natural to honor the man who's been the only mother I've had for more than 30 years. He's the one who taught me how to make homemade stuffing, successfully sew a zipper into a pair of pants, and combine just the right amount of flour and egg yolks to make noodles. This may not seem so unusual these days, when men are more sensitive and more flexible, but my dad took over mom duty when my mother died in 1974, well before the movie Mr. Mom made grocery shopping, bread baking, laundry doing dads cool, and he took his mom role seriously. When I was getting ready to graduate from elementary school, my friends' mothers took them shopping for new dresses. My dad went to the fabric store and bought a pattern, shimmering material, and sewing doodads, then spent several hours huddled over the sewing machine to make a beautiful dress for me. When I was having trouble in sewing class making a pair of shorts, he not only helped me finish them, but also made me a week's worth of shorts in bicentennial material so I looked really hip during the summer of 1976. When I needed to take a treat to my school's bake sale, Dad headed to the kitchen, grabbed a tin of Hershey's cocoa, and baked a pan of brownies. His ego was boosted when those brownies were the first to sell out. None of this was a threat to his manhood, even though men at that time were often judged by how cool they looked in their leisure suits or how well they danced the hustle. His self-esteem was strengthened when, at sleepovers, I would model the flannel pajamas he made for me. He enjoyed the flabbergasted looks when he gave people gifts of homemade preserves. Dad did all this while he worked full-time, ran a household, and raised a daughter alone. So each year, as I struggled to find the perfect Mother's Day card for him, it would be easier to forget it. After all, Father's Day is just a month later, right? Au contraire. One year I neglected to send a Mother's Day card, and I still hear about it. My father often says he's more proud of what he accomplished as my mother than as my father, because being a mother was so much harder. But if you think that means I can forget him on Father's Day. Pat France Sircone, Bradford, Pennsylvania, Communications Director, daughter of Richard L. France, barber, machinist, 1938.
The cook. Dad recovered quickly enough from heart failure. Learning how to cook took a little longer.
My mother died in 1972, quite suddenly, of a massive heart attack. She and Dad had been married for almost 40 years, and he was devastated. The night of her funeral, my father was admitted to the hospital with heart failure and was in intensive care for a number of days. Things looked pretty grim, and then suddenly, he recovered. When asked how he pulled through, he said he remembered that he had two girls at home who still needed him. He became our cook while I went to work and my younger sister attended nursing school. Becoming our cook was no easy task because he was unfamiliar with the kitchen and what went on there. Some days we arrived home to find the front door opened wide, which meant that dinner had burned and we would be eating in a restaurant. One day he called me at work at around 2 p.m. and said, "Doris, at what temperature and for how long do you cook chicken?" I didn't know the answer. Mom had spoiled us all, so I told him to hold on while I checked with a coworker. I got back on the line and said, "350 degrees, Dad, for about an hour." There was silence on the other end of the line. I waited a few seconds and said, "Dad, are you still there? Is everything okay?" "Everything is fine," he replied. "But can you come home now? Your dinner is ready." Doris Schluter, Locust Grove, Virginia, retired manager, daughter of John Jack Peter Schluter, chauffeur, 1910 to 1973.
The astronomer. If you ask me, the word of the day is unconditional.
When my parents divorced in the late 1960s, I was 3 and my sister was 1. At 27, willingly and lovingly, my father began raising his 2 little girls. His entertaining teaching methods actually made me look forward to our study time together, especially when we were learning about the solar system and one planet in particular. You know the one. He would point his finger first at me and then at his backside. At one point, he decided that my sister and I would learn one new word per day. I loved the day we opened the dictionary to dolichocephalic. We still laugh about that one, but I actually remember what it means. And I will always remember representing my elementary school in a state spelling bee. Dad and I spent countless hours studying the word list. I really thought I could go all the way, but I was eliminated early on. When I returned home after my devastating loss, under my pillow was a beautifully wrapped box. In the box was a gold bracelet and a note that said, "With absolute love, Dad." Oh, so that's how absolute is spelled. The bracelet is long gone, but 27 years later, the note is one of my prized possessions. I still wonder how Dad got the gift and the note under my pillow before I raced to bed to wallow in my sorrow. He took my loss over absolute and replaced it with absolute love. Pamela Lazarus Dapper, mother, Tequesta, Florida, daughter of Howard Lazarus, real estate, 1942.
The Baker. Like a number of fathers in this book, he played the cards that were dealt him, and he played them well.
My dad was born in New Jersey in 1895, the baby of 10 children born to German immigrants. During World War I, he served in France and Germany. We were poor, but life was good until the mid-1940s, when we noticed that his walking was unstable. He had developed a nervous disorder that we suspected was caused by exposure to mustard gas during the war. People said if they didn't know better, they'd think he was drunk. He was a carpenter by trade, but now he was unable to work. The roles were reversed in our family, and he became Mr. Mom long before it became fashionable, a hard adjustment for an active outdoorsman. Mom went to work at a baking company, packing donuts on an assembly line. Confined to home, Dad taught himself to cook and bake. He made awesome fudge, and how to sew, hook rugs, and so on. He did it all with a positive attitude, and he usually had a smile. When I started working, I would call him during the day. If he didn't sound cheerful, I would say, "Better get off the phone, I can smell your pie burning." Sure enough, when Mom and I got home, we were greeted by a big smile, a twinkle in his eye, and homemade pie for dessert. He found ways to overcome his disabilities. When my parents got a little dachshund puppy called Tiger, Dad figured out how to get him out during the day when Mom was at work. He taught him to climb in a basket, which Dad attached to the clothesline. Dad lowered the basket out the kitchen window, and when Tiger was ready to come inside, he hopped back in the basket and Dad pulled him in. Dad continued to be upbeat throughout his life as he struggled from cane to walker to wheelchair before becoming bedridden. Through all his suffering, he loved life, family, and friends, and was always ready for a party. He taught me to accept what life gives us. Maureen Harnett, Tarpon Springs, Florida, retired treasurer, daughter of Edward Schuer, homemaker, 1895 to 1980.
The transformation. He rolled his 2 roles into 1.
My parents had been together since the 7th grade. Their life on Cape Cod was wonderful and full, and they were grateful for their 7 children, 12 grandchildren, and 4 great-grandchildren. They were very devoted to each other. Early in 2004, Dad was hit with the blow of his life. His love, his soulmate, the woman he had taught to drive, cook, and swim, who had been his closest companion for more than 54 years, died of cancer at 75. He and the rest of our family were devastated. Mom had always been the epitome of good health. Dad had battled prostate cancer and still smoked. Without Mom, what would he do? The first decision he made was to remain in their home. He wanted her presence around him. Second, he got himself a dog. What happened next astonished us all. Dad changed. Always the rock behind Mom, he now began to take an active interest in the lives of his children and grandchildren. One of the first things he did was to make a note of all birthdays and important family events. A simple task, but never his. Then he started corresponding with people. Write a letter or send a card? Unheard of before this. He even started cooking and cleaning, household tasks he had never had to think about before. He amazed us by adopting all the rituals Mom had performed, and as time wore on, he sort of became Mom, giving advice for newborn grandchildren who couldn't get to sleep, making daily phone calls, consoling, advising, and arranging trips to visit his children who were far from home. Where did this inner strength come from? Were Mom and Dad having secret conversations in the middle of the night? Is Mom still there, giving him inspiration and the will to go on? The connection between them was deep. We know that. Their life together was a bit of a fairy tale. Was it their era? Was it their upbringing in a time where family and country were top priorities? I think their greatest gift to their children was their love and devotion for each other and their pride in their country. I salute my dad for continuing our family traditions and going on with life as if Mom were standing beside him. In some way, I guess she is. Susan C. LaJoy, Orleans, Massachusetts, mother, daughter of Francis E. LaJoy, retired engineer, 1928.
Hands and feet.
I look at my father's rough, worn, and cracked hands, and I am reminded of the life he has lived. Krista L. Paternostro, daughter of Thomas A. Paternostro.
Most of the chapter headings in this book seemed obvious to me, even before I started reading the letters. But a few of them took me by surprise, and this one was completely unexpected. The idea for this section jumped out at me when I read Andy Overbay's letter, which included a reference to his father's meaty paws. It was then I realized that, strangely enough, very few people wrote about their father's face or even his eyes, but a number of writers focused on their father's hands. I immediately thought back to the summer of 1998, when I was invited to address the annual convention of the New York State chapter of the American Legion. The event was held in Buffalo, and I was being given a journalism award. I began to talk about my dad and referred to him as the real Tim Russert. Big Russ and Luke were sitting together in the front row, and I noticed that Dad was wiping away a few tears with the back of his hand, using that big paw of his to dry his eyes. And it wasn't just him, either. Many of the men in the room were wiping away tears with their hands. No handkerchiefs for these guys. When I was a boy, Dad's hands did so much. He used them at work, of course, to lift trash cans and drive his truck, but at home they had a different purpose. Whenever my sisters and I acted up, Mom would swat us on the rump. "Keep this up," she would say, "and you'll have to deal with the big hand." One of several nicknames for our dad, whose hands and forearms were very well developed from all his years of manual labor. It wasn't just my dad who was defined by his hands. It was so many dads like him. One of the most poignant moments of my life in government occurred when I was working for Senator Moynihan, and we attended a hearing in Buffalo about the plight of unemployed steelworkers. A big, burly man of 48 was testifying, and he was in tears. "Senator," he said, "look at these hands. These hands can still work. Give me some work, Senator. Give me my dignity." Everybody in the room was fixated on those big, empty hands, wishing there was some way to fill them. I grew up at a time when just about every father, or so it seemed, was good with his hands and could fix basic plumbing or electrical problems around the house. Before you'd call a carpenter or a plumber, you'd fix it yourself, and if you couldn't, you'd bring in a neighbor or a relative. Every father in our neighborhood had a workbench in the basement and knew how to use it, but I guess not every trade is passed down through the generations. I have no talent in this area, which is a source of some amusement and occasional disappointment in our house, and considerable expense as well. When I left Buffalo, moved to Washington, and started meeting people in government and in the media, something about them seemed different. And then it hit me. Their handshakes weren't as firm, and their hands were much softer than the hands of the men I had known growing up. People speak of white collar and blue collar as if the difference lies in the shirt a person wears. Maybe so, but it also lies in their hands. Just as I used to focus on my father's hands, Luke used to focus on mine. When he was little, at least once a year, he would measure his hand against mine, palm to palm. I can still remember the smile on his face, and mine too, when his hand grew to become the same size as mine, and then a few months later, when it was finally bigger. It was another rung on a young man's climb to adulthood. Hermes' hands. He proved that 8 fingers were as good as 10.
Wisconsin winters can be harsh, but the people who live there are a hearty lot. My dad, known as Hermie, traveled the streets and side roads of Columbus, and at one point he delivered mail, a smile, and a joke to every citizen in the city limits and surrounding rural area. Even in winter, he rarely, if ever, missed a day of work. Handling large bundles of mail had to be awkward in such conditions, but he mastered it with only 8 fingers. When Hermie was 12, an unfortunate accident removed the ring and pinky fingers of his left hand. But he refused to consider this a handicap. Hermie used his hands to win the heart of my mom. In high school, he would stick the stubs in his nose and roll his eyes during class. Later, Mom would often say, "I had to marry a guy like that." Hermie used his hands to drive a tank during World War II, where he was in the thick of many battles, including the Battle of the Bulge. He downplayed what he did in the war and the 10 medals he received, but he never downplayed America. He considered it a duty and a privilege to serve. After the war, Hermie used his hands to teach me a passion for sports, how to be ready for the pitch in baseball, how to get up after you've been knocked down in football, and how to hustle and never quit in basketball. Around the house, Hermie used his hands to fix things. He also used them to make beautiful wooden items, tables, chairs, plates, and the family ping pong table, which somehow folded up into a small storage space. Mom would often say, "Your dad never said he loved me, but he would always make me something, so I knew he did." Dad's hands also demonstrated his love. They could touch your shoulder and make you feel better when you needed forgiveness. They could gather up the pieces when your heart was broken, and they could hold a family together when selfishness threatened to tear it apart. Although we didn't always realize it, and although he had only 8 fingers, Hermie's hands held our world together. John Hermanson, Knoxville, Tennessee, department manager, son of Lawrence Hermie Hermanson, postal worker, 1920 to 2004.
The gloves. When you don't have much, you hold on to whatever you've got.
My large hands held my daughter just moments after she was born. That was the last time I was ever afraid I might hold her too tight. I touched Amy's puffy, pink face and said, "It's okay, little face. I've got you now." I touched her cheek and felt her warmth and a tiny pulse. I put her cheek to mine, sniffed her new smell, and cried for joy and relief. My dad had probably held my sisters and me the same way. I don't know for sure, because he died when I was 18 months, new to the world and to the life that he and my mother created for us. He was sick most of his life, but was strong enough to be a talented musician, a skilled surgeon, and a loving husband and father in the days before drugs and kidney dialysis became the lifesavers they are today. He died just after Christmas in his 36th year. My mother believes he always knew his time was limited and that he tried to bring joy and life to us before it ran out. She says their 12 years together were a beautiful but too short story. She says my hands are just like his, and that I look like him and make her laugh like he did. I like the idea that my dad once held me in the same way I held Amy that day. As a young boy, I sometimes thought I heard his voice or his footsteps in the hall. I just wanted to see him. I know I'm connected to him, and I can often feel his presence. Not long ago, I came across his driving gloves in a small box of keepsakes. I slipped my hands into them and sat quietly at my desk, knowing this would be as close as I could get to his physical existence. The gloves fit me perfectly, as if I had chosen them myself. Maybe he wore them while driving us all to church. Maybe he matched them up with the tweed jackets and handsome wool suits I have seen in the few remaining pictures of him. The only smell is of aging leather, without what his signature scent might have been. John Brink, Duxbury, Massachusetts, divinity student, son of John C. Brink, physician, 1912-1948.
The clock. His hands were clean, and so was his conscience.
Sometimes I would pick up Dad from work at Universal Studios, where he was a tool and die maker. He got off work at 3:30 p.m. When I arrived at 3:20, I noticed that all the men he worked with were washing up and heading to the time clock to punch out at 3:30. But my dad clocked out at 3:30 and then washed his hands. When I asked him why, he said, "They don't pay me to wash my hands." He also liked to say, "I only work half a day, 12 hours." Phil Robbins, Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, sales. Son of Leo Robbins, tool and die maker, 1923-1993.
The knuckles. These were the hands of a working man.
I remember my father's strong hands with slightly oversized knuckles, a common trait for someone who worked with tools. His hands were unusually clean, a rarity among automobile mechanics. Always, before leaving his shop, he followed a lengthy ritual of washing his hands, first with kerosene and then water, using a stiff brush and lots of lava soap. He finished by carefully cleaning his fingernails with a pocket knife. The lava soap, combined with the lingering smell of cigarettes, produced his unique odor, neither pleasant nor unpleasant. As he aged, the big knuckles became even more pronounced and the victims of arthritis. The skin became more mottled with liver spots, and eventually those strong hands had a bit of a tremor, but to me, at least, they never lost their feeling of strength. Don Spradling, El Paso, Texas, investment services, son of Al Spradling, car mechanic, 1903-1991.
Size 17. He let his hands do the talking.
My dad was best known for his hands. Strong and hardened by years of exposure to every harsh environment imaginable, a handshake from Dad was still an adventure when he was 79. 20 years as a tractor mechanic for the local International Harvester dealership, combined with decades of dairy farming, left him with meaty paws that snared your hand in his grasp. I was in grade school before I knew there was a way to clean your hands and face with something other than lava heavy-duty soap. I saw those hands bashed, mashed, and bleeding far too many times. I even saw the bone on one finger after an unfortunate encounter with a truck fan cowling. He lost his size 17 wedding ring to an injury that left his finger so swollen that the ring had to be sawed off. On the eve of our college graduation, my friends described meeting Dad as like shaking hands with a bear, and one of them insisted on showing me how Dad's hand had swallowed his own. His hands were even the subject of discussion on a radio show, where a war of words had developed about the pros and cons of our government's support of agriculture. In response to a call from a woman who denounced farmers as lazy welfare recipients, someone called in a rebuttal. He didn't mention Dad by name, but his description left no doubt. He said that when you shook hands with Dad, his hands are so rough that you hurt for what he must have been through, but at the same time you're proud to know that people like this still exist in America. I can close my eyes and remember sitting at the breakfast table, listening to that broadcast with Mom and Dad. When the segment was over, Dad sat quietly in the corner. He looked at his hands and rubbed them. I don't know if he was proud or embarrassed or a little of both. His eyes were clouded by emotion, but in typical Dad style, he said nothing. Then he went out and continued to do the things that had shaped those hands. Andy Overbay, Chilloway, Virginia, extension agent, son of David Overbay, farmer, 1925 to 2005.
The Crutches. It's inspiring to read about fathers who were able to make light of their own disabilities, to the point where their kids grew up thinking that everybody lived this way.
My father, born in 1925, contracted polio at the age of 5, the most severe kind, infantile paralysis. He was told he would never walk again, but he taught himself to walk with heavy metal braces and crutches. When I was 4 and met a friend's father for the first time, I asked her, "Where are your father's crutches?" My brother once asked at the dinner table how old he had to be before he would get his crutches. Sometimes we went to the beach. My father could swim like a fish, but having no use of his legs, he was easy to dunk under the water. It was fun for the moment, but payback was always tough. Getting him out of the water always ended in disaster. 2 of us would carry him out and put him on a blanket so he wouldn't get all sandy pulling himself out and dragging on his bottom back to the blanket. He would invariably start to giggle, causing us to giggle, and eventually we would drop him in the sand. We never saw him as having a disability. We would be holding a door for him, and like any other kid, we would say, "Hurry up, Dad!" People would look at us like we were horrible, but Dad would just laugh and say, "I'm coming." Deborah Campbell, South Berwick, Maine, administrative assistant, daughter of Robert C. Hughes, radio broadcaster, 1925.
Gentle hands. A whole life is conveyed in just 3 sentences and 2 hands.
I look at my father's rough, worn, and cracked hands, and I'm reminded of the life he has lived. He worked hard, sacrificed for his family, and struggled for everything he has ever had. But underneath that rough exterior are gentle hands that picked us up when we cried, carried us through the rough spots, pulled us up when we fell down, patted us on the back when we achieved success, and hugged us each night before we went to bed as he told us how much he loved us. Krista L. Paternostro, Simpsonville, South Carolina, Association Executive, daughter of Thomas A. Paternostro, Child Advocate, 1939.
Being there.
It's never too late to begin the process of becoming the father you want to be, the one you always wished you had. Alan Shedlin, Jr., son of Alan Shedlin.
In an often quoted line, Woody Allen once said that 80% of success is just showing up. With apologies to Woody, I would amend that statement to read that 99% of parenting consists of just being there. Not long ago, I was at a sports banquet where I sat with the great NFL quarterback Peyton Manning and his dad Archie, another great quarterback, who was being honored that night. When it was his turn to speak, Peyton Manning stood up and said, "My dad always had a knack for making his children feel certain and secure." To me, that was another way of saying that Archie Manning was always there for his kids. And he must have done something right because his 2 sons, Peyton and Eli, are both playing in the NFL. Sometimes dads can't be around when they most want to be there. Because Big Russ worked 2 full-time jobs, he could never come to my Little League games. He would return from his first job around 5:30 and have supper and a brief nap before leaving for his second job, which started at 8. One afternoon, he came home and noticed I wasn't around. Where's Timmy? He asked Mom. He had a Little League game, she said. I guess it's running late. Actually, the game had started late because of a rain delay. I still remember that day. I finished my paper route and rode off on my bike to Cazenovia Park, the recreational center of our neighborhood, where I played second base for the Braves. I was halfway there when I realized I had forgotten to bring my belt, but I didn't have time to go back. We were the home team, and in the bottom of the sixth and final inning, the score was tied. I was on second base when the batter hit the ball into right field. As I was rounding third, the coach yelled at me to keep going. Then, as I was streaking to the plate, my pants started falling down, and as I slid into home, they were down around my ankles. Safe! Yelled the umpire. My teammates were cheering as I slowly got up, elated and embarrassed at the same time. As I rubbed my poor, aching backside, I looked up. There, to my astonishment, was Dad, happily puffing on a White Owl cigar. Dad, I said, it hurts so much. And Dad, who wasn't really known as a poet, called back, Never mind your bun, you scored a run. I thought of that day during the summer of 2005 when the New York Times ran a story about the Little League World Series. The game ended with a dramatic home run by Michael Mamiya of the West Oahu, Hawaii team, defeating Curaçao 7-6. I was happy for the American kids, of course, but I was especially interested in one of their fathers. As soon as his son's team qualified for the World Series, Myron Enos, a truck driver, had asked his boss for time off to go to Williamsport. When his boss refused to grant it, Enos quit. It was definitely worth it, he said. It was a big sacrifice, but you know, it was my family or my job. You only have one family. You can get plenty of jobs. Over the years, I've spoken to a number of men who made a different choice, who put their careers first, and later wished they had been around more when their children were young. I'll never forget a conversation I had with former Senator George McGovern, the 1972 Democratic presidential candidate. He had written a book called Terry about his daughter, an intelligent, compassionate, and funny woman who died of alcoholism at the age of 45. I read a lot of books, but this one was so sad that I had to put it down several times. As a father, it just tore me up, especially when McGovern quoted some of Terry's diary entries. In one of them, she addressed her father saying, Dad, I wish you were home more. Dad, I wish you could understand what I'm going through. Although he was proud of his public service, McGovern was speaking for many sadder and wiser fathers when he said to me, What I regret is that I didn't carve out more of those precious times to be with my kids. I really can't tell you how I regret that. This chapter is about a group of men who didn't make that mistake, about fathers who, in one way or another, really were there for their kids. The Seminarian. It's one thing to be there for your son. It's another to stand by him even when he breaks your heart.
My father, born in Ireland at the turn of the century, was so proud when my brother walked across the stage of All Hallows High School to receive his diploma, the first member of our family ever to do so. When I graduated 3 years later and told him I was thinking of going to college, he didn't know what to make of it. But when I told my parents a few weeks later that the college I was thinking of was the New York Seminary, I knew they were bursting with pride. In those days, nothing was more prestigious for an Irish family than for their son to head toward the priesthood. My 8 years in the seminary were long and difficult. As I entered my final year, there were a lot of necessary preparations for the ordination in May: the choice of a catering hall, the invitation list, the seating arrangements. It was just like a wedding, but without the bride. The months went by quickly as my home parish, St. Anselm's, was gearing up for the Carroll family's big day. As Christmas came and went, a faint but disturbing thought began to invade my consciousness. Did I really want to become a priest? Did I really want to take vows that would determine the course of the rest of my life? That year I had the privilege of singing a solo at St. Patrick's Cathedral during the Holy Week services. When it was over, I was allowed home for the remainder of the day. But my mom and dad had no time to speak with me. They were too busy finalizing the arrangements for my ordination, which was now only 6 weeks away. Back at the seminary, my thoughts continued to haunt me until I finally made the decision to abandon my goal and begin a different life. I had a friend who was already a priest and was stationed at a church about a mile from my home. I told him what I had decided, and he said he would leave a car on the seminary grounds so that after I made my decision known to the seminary authorities, it would be easy for me to leave. On a quiet Monday morning in April 1961, as the rest of the students attended classes, I slowly drove through the seminary gates into the streets of Yonkers, leaving an entire lifetime behind. I went straight to my friend's rectory in the southeast Bronx. "What'll I do, Joe? How do I go home and tell them? It'll break their hearts." He volunteered to go to my house and speak with my parents first. He returned less than an hour later. "Tom, it's okay. It's time to go home." I walked into that little apartment that I had known all my life. My parents were seated together on the couch. I just stood there. I had nothing to say. I started to cry and to tell them I was sorry and that I didn't know why I had waited so long. "You have nothing to be sorry about, son," my father said. "You've done nothing wrong." As he spoke, the boxes of unmailed invitations were sitting off to the side as a cruel reminder of my unfinished obligation. He stood up and faced me. "No one can live your life for you, except yourself. Must have been hard on you these past months. You said nary a word to a soul. Me and your mother are proud of you. 'Twas a tough thing you had to do." I stood there, awkward and embarrassed. With a nod of his head toward the kitchen, he said, "Come on now. The tea'll be getting cold. You can be bringing a cup to your ma'am." My mother died of cancer just 3 months later. My father lived for another 10 years, but he never once brought up the topic again, let alone questioned my decision. He showed me right to the end of his life what it means to be a father, and I'll never forget that he was really there for me on the day when it counted the most. Tom Carroll, Mamaroneck, New York, retired college dean, son of Barney Carroll, stationary engineer, 1899 to 1971.
The Heisman. You wouldn't want to see a father do this too often, but once in a lifetime, what a memory.
My dad was born and raised in Ohio, and after World War II, he attended Ohio State University. I was in the eighth grade sitting in math class when I heard the school secretary say over the intercom that I should come immediately to the office because my father was waiting for me there. Of course, I feared the worst, but when I saw him standing there, he had a big grin on his face. When I asked why he had come, he said, "Archie Griffin won the Heisman Trophy about an hour ago, and I wanted to tell you first." Archie Griffin was the great Ohio State halfback, and my father was so excited, he just couldn't help himself. Jeremy Kahn, Olney, Maryland, sales. Son of Jerry H. Kahn, insurance broker, 1923 to 1990.
The latecomer. There should be a first time for everything, even at 87.
My dad took an earlier flight than he had planned, so he could get to the dock in time to see me shove off for my certifying exam in sculling. At 87, he looked incredibly robust, and he was carrying his camera to record this mini milestone in a sport I had taken up only a week earlier to commemorate my 60th birthday. I had always wanted to learn to row, but had never had the time. I had always wanted my father to show an interest in my athletic endeavors, but he never seemed to have the time. For decades, I told myself that expectations for men in the 1940s and 1950s were different from today, and that fathers had not been expected to be much more than breadwinners and disciplinarians. But all my rationalizing did little to lessen the sadness I felt. Sometimes there is a roughness to the world that only a dad can smooth out. I could never have imagined that I would have to wait until I was the grandfather of 4, and he the great-grandfather of 8, for him to attend one of my sports events. And I certainly couldn't have known that his showing up at one would still matter to me and would feel so good. I guess the desire and need for paternal support and approval is so strong that it trumps reasonable evidence that such support may not be forthcoming. Even when submerged, the longing remains intense. While the biological act of fathering entails no real commitment, the ongoing process of daddying requires a lifelong commitment to your children. But it's never too late to begin the process of becoming the father you want to be, the one you always wished you had. Alan Shedlin Jr., Chevy Chase, Maryland, parenting coach, son of Alan Shedlin, businessman, 1915 to 2002.
The listener. The image of a father and a son lying in bed and sharing confidences is a welcome antidote to the pains of adolescence.
My dad was a milkman who got up 5 days a week at 3 a.m. He would drive from Brooklyn, where we lived, to the plant in the Bronx, and then to the Upper East Side of Manhattan to deliver milk. Because he had to get up in the middle of the night, my father was usually in bed by 8. On Monday nights, my mom would go out to play cards with the girls. When she was gone, I would go into my parents' room and ask Dad if I could speak with him. He always said yes, and we would lie there in his bed as I poured my heart out to him, often about being teased by other kids. He was completely supportive. On any number of occasions, he explained that the torment and embarrassment I was feeling as an adolescent would pass, and that the healthy thing was to let it go and not act on my anger. It was good advice, but more important, he was telling me these things when he was utterly exhausted. When Mom came home from her evening out, she'd have a fit that Dad was still up. But I will always remember that Dad felt that talking with me was even more important than his rest. He was always there, with advice, an encouraging word, or just a grip of his strong, rough hands. Ira M. Garvin, Oakdale, New York, retired teacher. Son of Leo M. Garvin, milkman, 1913 to 1967.
The announcement. When a father isn't careful, his pride can lead to his daughter's embarrassment. When a father is fortunate, his daughter forgives him.
I was the first college graduate in our family. A few years later, in a solemn ceremony, I was sworn into the bar as a lawyer in the great Maryland Court of Appeals building. As my name was called, my father stood and said in a loud, strong voice, "That is my daughter!" I was mortified. Years earlier, while sitting at his knee every Saturday night as we watched Perry Mason, I had proudly announced, at the age of 7, that I was going to be a lawyer. This was not only my goal, it was obviously a dream fulfilled for him, too. How I wish I could hear that voice today. Elvira M. White, Princess Anne, Maryland, law professor, daughter of Olden M. White, railroad worker, steam engineer, 1911 to 1986.
The ally. A rare breed. The dad who could hear a problem without needing to solve it.
Teenagers often struggle to get along with their parents, and my mother was the one I struggled with. Neither of us seemed to be able to understand the other or communicate effectively. When things got especially hard, I would climb into the cab of my dad's pickup truck or the front seat of the car, and we would sit in the driveway and talk. I would tell him how tough things were going from my perspective, and he simply listened without taking sides. That in itself is pretty remarkable. As I learned later on, men typically try to fix problems rather than listen to them. But my dad was a great listener, which helped me immensely. He listened until I had shed all my tears and expressed all my feelings, even though it must have been hard for him to hear the emotional ups and downs of a teenage girl who wasn't getting along with his wife. Although he worked long hours, when I needed him, he was always there. Bonnie J. Morris, Coon Rapids, Minnesota, medical transcriptionist, daughter of Paul W. Wojohn, retired game warden, 1921.
Loss.
Hell to get old, but hell not to. Thomas A. O'Halloran, father of Linda Nitz.
I didn't expect that my introduction to this section would be so personal, but on August 14, 2005, after a short but difficult battle with cancer, my mother died. A couple of weeks later, an old friend, after expressing her sympathy, said to me that one of the hardest parts of losing a parent is realizing that you are no longer a child. How right she was. For 55 years, I had my mom to care for and comfort me. When she left us, it felt as if an enormous part of my earlier life left with her. It's hard to remember that things are different. I still find myself reaching for the phone to call her. Friends who've lost a parent.